Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to this edition of The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you to attend one of our worship services. We meet each Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. for the Divine Service. If you don't live in Orpington, however, and you live in the Medway towns, why not come along on the first Sunday of each month at 3 o'clock to the Evangelical Free Church on Widmore Road, where our Little Reina Mission meets. And if you live in Glasgow or in the Glasgow area, I also serve as vacancy pastor of St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride. They meet each Sunday at 11 a.m. and again, would like to invite you to attend there. However, if you don't live in any of these areas, go to our website, lutheran.co.uk. Click on the directory button. Find the congregation that's closest to you. Go and pay them a visit. I know that you will be blessed. Again, thank you for your prayers and for your financial support of Lutheran Radio. It means so much to us to know that so many people around the world keep us in their prayers and contribute to our worldwide ministry, and we very much appreciate your kindness and your generosity. Last week, we began a discussion on the small called articles with Dr. Robert Rosine. Dr. Rosine is a professor emeritus of historical theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. And it's great to have you back with us, Bob. And thanks for joining us again.
Thanks very much. Nice to be back.
Last week, we talked or started talking about the small called articles, and I would encourage folks to go to, if you've missed it, go back and listen to the podcast, as that gives a sort of a long run up to the small called articles. And last week, you got us up to actually December of 1536, where Luther's prince had asked him to write these articles. Again, can you perhaps tell us why that happened and how Luther did that and the importance of these articles?
Sure. Paul III, in June of 1536, issued an invitation to a council in the city of Mantua. Mantua is in, if you look at today, North Italy. Politically speaking, at the time, it was actually Holy Roman Emperor territory. So it's an Italian town and area within the German Empire. This is important because it keeps Charles V happy, because it's sort of a land that he has influence over. But it's also close enough to Rome, where Paul can also have influence as well. People are called to this council. It's going to be held the next year in 1537. The Lutherans have to decide what will they do about it. They decided, well, we can't really ignore it. We have to go. John Frederick then decided that he would have Luther draft a statement that they could use as a kind of explanation of what they a declaration, really, of what they stood for, to make the point that they are church and that they belong in the church and they're not outcasts on the outside. It is a little different than the Augsburg Confession. That was a document made for a political assembly, and it is said in a kind of kind and ironic fashion. I mean, it's clear, it's plain, but it's not always very confrontational. It was done by Philip Melanchthon. That's part of the reason. That's kind of his nature to write that way. And Luther said that's fine. He was pleased with the writing, although Luther said if he had anything to add to it, it would have been something on the papacy. They decided not to do that at the time because it was a political diet, and there's no point embarrassing Charles by bringing up the papacy. Just ignore it. Just talk about themselves as church. Now Luther's going to write the document, and in the years that followed, and with all the water that's kind of gone over the dam, Luther is a little bit more... Well, I don't know if confrontational is the right word. He's a little bit more impatient, we might say. He's willing to be a bit more blunt. He's blunt anyway, but he's willing to kind of lay it on the line and say clearly what we think. And if people are a little bit aghast at that, so be it. If it's the truth, you know, Luther said once, peace if possible, but truth at any rate. So John asked Luther to draft something, and Luther did this at the end of the year in December of 1536. He does this in Wittenberg. In Wittenberg, he's got a nice little group of people who met often to discuss things theological. You know, he also had done his translation of the New Testament back in 1522 and the Old Testament finished in 1534. The Wittenberg theological faculty regularly met and talked about things in his Bible translation, if they were the best said, and they would have discussions and changes were made. So he's got this ready little group that he can bounce things off of, and they work with each other. You know, I mean, you can say something bluntly, they'll argue it out. Who might be right, who might be wrong, what could be improved. And so Luther drafts his articles and bounces them off this group. It includes Philip Melanchthon, Justice Jonas, who did yeoman service. Jonas is younger than Melanchthon, I mean, younger than Luther, rather, and is probably Luther's closest ally on the faculty. We always think of Luther and Melanchthon, but Jonas worked with Luther really closely and would translate Luther's things all the time from Latin and German for him, for the wide German public reading audience, and sometimes in reverse as well. Johannes Bugenhagen, who was the pastor of the city church, St. Mary's there, and also taught on the university. Nicholas von Amsdorf, who was fashioned himself as a kind of defender of Luther. Later on, Amsdorf would make himself a little bit of a pain in the neck, making sure that people said things the way Luther wanted them said, or maybe we should say the way Amsdorf thought Luther wanted them to be said. But he's got the cause at heart. That's the important thing to remember here. Johannes Agricola, who would later get himself involved in some theological controversies, and there are a few others as well. These people were gathered together and looked at Luther's writing, at what he had suggested they say at this council in Mantua the next year. Melanchthon read it, and he was a little bit aghast. His nature is not to be confrontational. It's to be a bit more ironic, to kind of reach out, to try and reach as widely as he possibly could, and to do it in a kind of peaceful fashion. He thought Luther was a bit too forceful and blunt, and he's not going to really reach reconciliation. He's going to say what he has to say. There's no doubt what's on Luther's mind, but is that really going to get us farther in our discussions? Melanchthon was particularly worried about what Luther had said about papacy. We'll come to this when we talk about the content, but papacy looms large in the center of Luther's theological presentation. Melanchthon said maybe we should say something of a positive nature, namely that we will admit to, or we will agree to live with the papacy, if the papacy will allow the gospel to be proclaimed, that if it will admit that it is of historic origin, in other words, that it is something that just historically evolved and is not something that Christ somehow instituted with Peter. You know, you are Peter and upon this rock. And Rome argued that Peter was the rock rather than the confession of Peter was the foundation for the church. That made it a matter of faith, an article of faith. If Rome, on the other hand, will say, well, it's just something that happened. There were many bishops, leaders in the East. Rome was pretty much by itself in the West, so it comes to enjoy a kind of outsized importance, looms large, and later could interject itself in controversies in the East, and that just made it even look larger. So it gradually rose. When the Roman Empire collapses, Rome fills a vacuum, and it not only teaches, but also has to really kind of civilize and hold things together. All that adds to the aura and to the prestige of the papacy. But see, that's all of kind of historical circumstance. If Rome will admit to that, and then the third part, along with allowing the gospel and admitting to the historical origin, is to be pastoral. Instead of acting like a ruler, like a potentate here, act instead like someone who really lives a Christ-like life, is willing to sacrifice, and lives and is willing to give all for the sake of the gospel being proclaimed among other people. If that were to happen, Melanchthon said, then we can live with the papacy. Well, I mean, Luther had no objection to that either. The chances of that happening are probably pretty slim, but it's worth saying. And the fact of the matter is Lutheranism hasn't really changed. When you read these documents and find that some very harsh and strong things are said about the papacy, but they also say that if the papacy is willing to change and to allow for this, we can live with it. The fact of the matter is it's never quite gotten to that point yet, though there's always kind of hope. Well, so Melanchthon registered some objection to this, and some of his other Luther's other colleagues made suggestions for what could be done with the articles. Luther took these sort of under advisement, although the truth is he didn't change terribly much, and then passed on a copy on the 3rd of January in 1536 to John Frederick. It happens to be the anniversary of the date he was excommunicated back in 1521. John Frederick read what Luther had given him, and he proclaimed it divine, Christian, and true. He was very pleased with it. You have to remember John Frederick, again, is a little bit of a kind of, well, we might say, he's not as much as Philip of Hesse. Philip of Hesse is a real red hot in support of the evangelical cause, a kind of aggressive exporter. John Frederick is an energetic exporter, not quite on Philip's level, but he's different than his predecessors, than his father, his uncle had been beforehand, and he wants to make a stand. He also wants to, he thinks he can get these articles through and get support of other princes and other theologians if they are handled quickly and smoothly at a meeting, which he's called for small called, at the start of the new year in January, February. As it turns out, there's a problem because Luther can't go to small called. Small called's in John Frederick's territory. That's not the issue. It's part of Thuringia, just kind of on the edge of his lands. That's okay. The problem is Luther himself. He ruined his health when he was a young man and a monk. Hours with on the cold stone floor, fasting for days on end, the kind of physical abuse that he really suffered at his own hand that way, gave him problems later in as an adult. Ringing in the ears, he had problems with digestion, he had problems with kidney stones, and that was the case here with kidney stones. Luther simply couldn't leave Wittenberg; he was too ill, too sick to go. So all that can happen is his articles can go, and others are going to have to talk about them. That, I think, is sort of, what can you say? You never know unless you could replay it all and not put Luther in the scene. But chances are that tipped the balance against a quick and favorable adoption of the articles. In February 1537, John Frederick called together this assembly of Lutheran theologians to consider what Luther had written. He decided that he wanted to spring it on them, and so he really kept it quiet, didn't even tell some of his closer friends and prince allies. There, suddenly, one day, are the articles out for their consideration. This is what Luther has put forth. Well, the ones from Wittenberg, those theologians who were there, had seen basically these things before. And Melanchthon had already mentioned before that he was concerned about the way in which Luther handled the papacy, whether he had Luther had done this as calmly and maybe as ironically as he might. Not that Melanchthon expected Luther to sound like Melanchthon, but at least he could maybe tone it down a little bit. The articles, though, failed for a couple of reasons. First, as I said, Luther was not present. He could have perhaps kind of pushed these through. You know, it's easier to get adoption of these things when the author's there in the room with you than when you have a chance where he's at far to sort of weigh in and say, well, what about this? Or maybe we should ask him to change that. Or might there be further consideration of this? You know, with the author present, that can be handled instantly. With Luther not there, well, it's another matter. Secondly, the thing is that John Frederick, by springing them on the other theologians who had come for this, really made a kind of tactical mistake. The theologians came in order to discuss, to dialogue, and to draft. They did not come as representatives authorized by their princes to sign and obligate the princes in the territory to some document. John Frederick hadn't really quite thought of that, or maybe hadn't quite grasped that. And so there was a reluctance by these theologians to commit. You know, personally, they looked at them, and personally, many of them signed these things. Melanchthon signed with reservations as far as conscience can allow, because what he's thinking about is the business about the papacy. But other theologians did. Some of them signed with a little note, you know, signing for my own person. In other words, not for my prince and my territory. So the idea that we now suddenly have a document that has not just simply John Frederick and Saxony behind it, but others as well, that didn't happen. They said in reply, these other theologians, well, we've already got documents. We've got the Augsburg Confession. We've also had a document from earlier in 1536. There was a thing called the Wittenberg Concord. They had held discussions with Upper Germans. Upper means, by the south border, because the land goes up. The farther away you go from the North Sea to the south end of the country, the landscape goes generally up into mountains. And so the Upper Germans, close to the Swiss, had discussed things with the Wittenbergers and had agreed to a document called the Wittenberg Concord, which was really quite an advance for them, because some of them leaned in a kind of reformed direction, where the Lord's Supper was more of a kind of representational meal, something like that. They gathered, however, and agreed that those who received the Lord's Supper, even if they did not have faith, did receive the body and blood of Christ. See, the Reformed would say, well, your faith makes it present. If you believe he's there, then this does you some good. And if you don't believe it, well, you've just gotten bread and wine, that's it. It's a kind of representational meal. The question is, what about the, and here's the Latin term, the manducatio indignorum, or the manducatio impiorum. Manducatio means the eating, mandication. Indignorum, the word dignus in Latin means the godly. Indignus is the ungodly, or the impiorum, you see the word pious there, or the impious. In other words, those who receive the Lord's Supper without faith, what happens to them? And these Upper Germans said, well, we believe that Christ is truly there because of the words of institution, and he's there in his promise, whether we believe it or not. And so at Smalcald, some of the theologians said, well, look, we just got through signing this thing. Why don't we use this as part of our statement as well, along with the Augsburg Confession? Because it says, in effect, we are church. There are others in the Reformation movement, radicals, who would have said, no, it's purely a kind of spiritual meal. Or it's like Swingley would say, it's only a historical commemoration. We're saying, no, and in fact, Christ is there. Rome thinks he's there too. Now, Rome will try to explain the presence with a thing they call transubstantiation, where the bread and the wine, the substance of those, turn into the substance of body and blood somehow. And instead, what we have is only the accidents, the characteristics of bread and wine left behind, but it's not really bread and wine. That, incidentally, is more Aristotle out of the Middle Ages. Luther just, he didn't want to go there at all. He says, it says Christ is there because of the word is. Don't try to rationalize why or how. It's a special sacramental presence, say. But what it means is that we believe he's there in promise with the word to forgive sins. They would argue over that. Is it our work that we're doing in the Lord's Supper, or is it a matter of God giving something to us? That's an issue they would have to hash out with Rome. But that the Lord's Supper is truly Christ, Use the Wittenberg Concord. Why don't we use that along with the Augsburg Confession, and we'll just be fine. So some wanted to only do that. They didn't want to add yet another statement. And some of them, as I mentioned, simply said, we're not delegates. We're simply here kind of in our own capacity as a theologian to take a further step, but not to commit or obligate anybody to this. So John Frederick's, you know, best laid plans sort of came to naught. Didn't happen. So the Smalcald Articles were not officially adopted as a confession at Smalcald. They were supported personally by many theologians, but not officially by any territories. In the aftermath of this, however, people went home and they started to use the small called articles anyway as a kind of further way of understanding Lutheranism. Luther himself took the small called articles and published them so that others could see what he'd done and written. And over time, they became support documents for other theological discussions. For example, in the 1550s, there were a number of dialogues, Lutherans with others, and when people would say, well, what do you believe about? They could pull these things out and say, well, here's something that Luther wrote, and it's been widely read and used in the past. It wasn't, again, officially a confession yet, but it gained kind of gradually a lot of support among theologians as something that was useful. It gets into the Book of Concord, this collection of theological statements that define the Lutheran Church, finally in 1580. It gets in there the same way the large and small catechism of Luther got in there. Nobody ever took a vote and said, let's put the large and small catechism in. Rather, those who were compiling the Book of Concord, given that task between 1577 and 1580, when they compiled documents, decided what would go in and how things would be handled, they put the catechisms in because they were so widely used and accepted that people understood the theology there. Surely they've got to be there. And the same thing happens with the small called articles. By 1580, it's just sort of a matter of course. Well, this is just something that's there, and is part of our repertoire. You know, it's another arrow in the quiver, so to speak, as we go out and talk theology with people. Instead, what happened at small called, rather than to sign on to Luther's, is that they signed on to something else, namely a document that Melanchthon put together. A document that dealt with the treatise on the power and the primacy of the Pope. Melanchthon took his objections that he laid out in Wittenberg, his three points, namely that the Pope should allow for the gospel, that he should admit that his office is purely a historical accident or coincidence, and that he then act pastorally and evangelically and genially with people rather than to rule as a prince and to claim power and authority over people's not just lives here but eternity, then he said things could be different. And he drafted this, explained this all in this document called the Treatise or the Tractatus on the Power and Primacy of the Pope. And that was agreed to by these other theologians. Again, not as a kind of confession, because they didn't have that kind of authorization from their people back home, but they liked what was said. It was a little bit more even keel, we might say, than the way Luther had talked a little bit in the small called articles. So this thing was drafted, was written in Latin by Melanchthon. Very quickly, it was translated into German and sent to the press. German editions were published. The thing is, when it went from Latin to German, Melanchthon's name was left off the title page. It's just an oversight. They were in a hurry, sent it. It was published, and it was printed, reprinted, reprinted, and then it began to be bundled with the small called articles. That came out of this meeting. This came out of this meeting. And the two were wedded together. It repeated right up to the days of the Book of Concord. When the drafters then decided to put this in, they put the small called articles in, and they put the Tractatus right behind the small called articles as if it were sort of an extension, something that Luther had written and appended to his earlier document. The truth is, Melanchthon saw it as that one missing piece from the Augsburg Confession, something about the papacy that we need to say now because we're going to a council. And so it's part of the Book of Concord in a kind of a mistaken way. Not that they didn't want it in the book. It's that it's sort of connected so often with the wrong document. Even when I went to seminary, the editions that we used all the time, put it right behind the small called articles. And we just sort of assumed at first, oh, that must be part of Luther's, till you get to class and you find out otherwise from the prof who lays the history out for you. And you find out what the real story is. At the time, people were so much in the dark about it. It wasn't really until the 18th century it was quite clear that Melanchthon had written this thing as a separate piece. So it's interesting how things kind of get lost for history. Didn't really matter to them. It didn't matter to them who wrote it. as far as they were concerned, it was right. It was something that they thought was theologically correct. And it really did repeat the same vein that Luther had been in before. You know, back in the 15-teens to the 20s, when Luther is laying out various theological treatises and attacking, he attacks authority, the papacy, not the idea that we can simply sort of get along without any kind of organizations, but the organizations' polity, as it were, church polity, is really an adiaphron. You can make this up and put it together as best suits your needs. And Luther, Luther became quite comfortable with that idea. He's willing to work with bishops, but if bishops stand in the way of the gospel, well, then somebody else has got to step in and do it. 1520, he wrote his address to the Christian nobility. Bishops have dropped the ball. You nobles need to be like fathers. Look out after your children, the people in your territory, and make sure that the gospel is preached. So if bishops won't lead Reformation, you have to find a way to provide for it, for others to lead Reformation. Bishops aren't pastors. They aren't, I said bishops, princes. Princes are not pastors. They are people who need to step in when the bishops have failed and provide, and others in the church then can do the job. And the papacy is fine too, unless, of course, it gets in the way of the gospel. Then we're going to find some other way to do this. But if the papacy is willing to stand by it, promote the gospel, and point to Christ, then we'll live with it. That was Luther's idea, and Melanchthon's really just kind of echoing that, although in a more soft-spoken way. Luther's treatise then, over the course of history, gained acceptance and found its way into the Book of Concord, even as the treatise on power and primacy of the Pope, Melanchthon's, though people had forgotten that it was Melanchthon, also was accepted over the course of time and bundled in with the rest. It served a useful purpose. What we need to do then now is to look at the particular doctrinal positions of the small called articles. And there are many pages, but there's a kind of simple introduction to them. There's a core, a matter which Luther says on which everything else will kind of rise and fall. And then there are other doctrines he brings up. They're important doctrines, but they are also things that he thinks will take care of themselves if we get the core right. You know, that's often the way things are. You can fuss around the edges with things that are peripheral or things that are important but maybe secondary. But if you don't get the hub of the matter, if you don't get to the essence or the kernel of the thing, the rest of it is just never going to quite work, never quite fall in place. You know, if you don't get Christ and cross in the right place and understand how to look at it correctly, if you don't understand about justification and the forgiveness of sins, everything else you say about church, about baptism, about Lord's Supper, about the ministry, about everything else in the Christian life, really isn't going to count for much, because you'll forever be kind of fixing things, you know, correcting them. If you've got the stalk, though, the trunk of the matter there firmly rooted, the rest of these things can hang there and can do great service. They all become part of a really wonderful picture.
Dr. Rosine, thank you for bringing us to this point in our discussion on the small called articles. And we look forward to getting to the core with you next week. And we invite our listeners back as we'll carry on this conversation. Thanks again, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.